I hope everybody had a good lunch. If not, you'll have a nice dinner, I suppose. Huh? Okay, well, it's a great pleasure to start this afternoon session, and we are very honored to have former President Leonel Fernandez as our keynote speaker. Leonel is an outstanding Latin American. He has been not only the political career, that is an excellent one as the leader of his party, president of the country, but also very well known in the intellectual side. He has a very important foundation that's working on issues of democracy on the regional level. Now he's the president of ELAC. It's the Latin America European Foundation. We are very happy that you are taking over that position, and I'm sure that you will be quite supportive of the strengthening of relationship between the two regions. But in addition to that, he is a person who is so capable in building consensus. I have seen him acting as president in some summits of presidents where some very difficult situations appear. I'm not going to mention the names of the presidents, but there were very hectic moments. One was in Dominican Republic, and the other one was in Mexico. And in both cases, his ability to find a way that two presidents who were really in a very strong confrontational situation got to an agreement and became friends, at least for the time being. So thank you very much. And we are very pleased that you will give us your views on the central issue of this conference. And more recently, you have been involved in supporting some of the democratic process in Latin America as observer in several elections. So you have a grasp of what are the issues of governance in the world and, of course, in Latin America. So, President and friend, I'm very pleased to welcome you on behalf of this audience. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Don Enrique, for that very kind and warm introduction. And I also would like to thank the LSE authorities for their kind invitation for me to participate here today in this great event, the third annual conference, CAF-LSE, on global governance and the relationship between both of our regions, Europe and Latin America and the Caribbean. Well, as you can see, I'll be speaking today about navigating through global governance in an age of uncertainty. And I would like to begin by, I know that here in the UK, perhaps one of the most admired sports is cricket, I think, no? Well, back in my region is baseball. And in my country, the Dominican Republic, sometimes it's called baseball land. Well, anyhow, I'm saying this because there was a baseball player named Yogi Berra. And Yogi Berra was a New York Yankee legendary baseball player, but was also a very witty man. And he said something that I always found very interesting. He said that it is difficult to make predictions, especially when it's about the future. And this is what it's all about. You can imagine then what it is like not to have the skills of a magician or have a crystal ball by your side to analyze and interpret the unpredictable events and uncertainties of current global affairs. Major media outlets around the world indicate on their headline news that 2016 has begun on a bumpy road. The Chinese stock market has plummeted in such an unexpected way that authorities temporarily suspended its share trading. The Shanghai Composite Index dropped 10% during the first week of the year, its largest decline since August 2015, and the smaller Shenzhen Composite fell 6.6%. In all, $1.3 million US dollars were wiped out in stock exchange markets, making it the worst first week in any year. The plunge in the Chinese stock market provoked ripple effects throughout the US, Europe, and Asia, causing global equities to continue sliding to a three-month low. As a result, the Dow Industrial Average lost over 1,000 points in the first week of 2016, down 6.2%. The broader S&P was down 6%, and the NASDAQ, which trades with the technological companies, dropped 7.3%. That means that overall, in just a week, U.S. stocks lost $1.36 trillion. London's leading shares closed down 2%. The benchmark FTSE 100 index fell 119.30%, 30 points to nearly 6,000 points. Other European stock markets behaved even worse than London's. Is the case, for example, in Paris, it fell 1.7%. Frankfurt's DAX was down 2.3%. And in Asia, Hong Kong's Hang Seng dropped 3.1%, while Japan's Nikkei was 2.3%. On the currency markets, going beyond the stock market exchange, on the currency markets, China's central bank set the yuan's value at its weakest level since March 2011, and concerns over the Chinese currency increased since a surprise devaluation was implemented in August last year. On that occasion, China's authorities stated that they were hoping to allow market forces more control over their currency. But since then, the central bank has spent billions of dollars to strengthen the currency, which now has lost 60% against the U.S. dollar. And this is interesting because, as we will see later on, it is the appreciation of the U.S. dollar that is also causing the fall of the oil prices. It's not only supply and demand, but also the strengthening of the U.S. dollar, which has to do with the depreciation or devaluation of the yuan in China. Chinese markets had stabilized in the last quarter of 2015 after a summer crash that caused trillions of dollars in losses. The pound fell by more than 1.5 cents against the euro for a 1.2 fall, and sterling also slipped by 0.5% against the dollar. Hence, I could say that with the ending of the Christmas holidays, because of the volatility and uncertainty that has been extended to global markets, it can be stated that thus far, this year, 2016, cannot be considered a very happy new year. So we go to the unpredictable. For over 40 years, since the end of the Second World War, a continuous rivalry persisted between the two world's major superpowers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Even though between them a major military confrontation never occurred because of the threat of a nuclear conflict, many proxy wars and military interventions did take place within their respective spheres of influence. Within that background, no one really predicted that the Berlin Wall would come down as easily as it did. It was, in a real sense, an unexpected occurrence, as so was the flow of events that continued. For sure, no one predicted either the abrupt downfall of the authoritarian regimes in Eastern Europe or the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was a totally unforeseeable event. So it seems that the unexpected, the non-predictable, have become a new trend in global affairs that challenges traditional approaches to analysis and forecasting. However, since the end of the Cold War, the world has been experiencing major transformations. It can be assured that humanity in general is going through a profound historical breakthrough. The times in which we're living undoubtedly signal a critical rupture with the past. This, as a consequence, has given way to remarkable, outstanding economic, political, social, environmental, and technological changes. It has been a period of exhilarating and rapid transfiguration. We have witnessed the progress made in different areas of human endeavor. We have seen the rise in economic output, the improvements in communications and transportation systems, greater trade and investment links, more traveling, and increased upward social mobility in different places of the world. We have also experienced the creation of disruptive technologies, the increase of productivity, and how the world's interconnectedness and interdependence has even altered the notions of space and time. Among the most significant changes that have occurred in the past quarter of a century, we have to consider the impact of globalization, the digital revolution, global terrorism, and the 2008 global financial crisis. But as unpredictable and volatile as the world has become, it is also now more complex, more fragile, dangerous, and uncertain. Nevertheless, we're still operating within the same institutional framework that was created at the end of the Second World War, as was stated here in the first panel this morning. Each one of the panelists reiterated the idea of how we're going through this transformational process, but with the same institutions created after the Second World War. And within the context, we're still operating in 2016 within the context of the Yalta and Potsdam conferences and the Bretton Woods system. It is now then required that we move a step further and that the international community, in a responsible way, make a long-standing contribution in the overhaul of major multilateral organizations such as the UN system, the World Bank, IMF, WTO, destined to guarantee peace, security, financial stability, the flow of goods and services, and sustainable development in this very turbulent 21st century, which may well be remembered by future historians as an age of great uncertainty. Recent approval by the UN General Assembly of the post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals was an important step on the right path. But so was the historic agreement made in Paris by 195 nations at the end of 2015 to combat climate change and keep a global temperature rise during this century below 2 degrees Celsius. There is now the need to move forward on the Doha Development Agenda, which was also discussed extensively this morning, make progress on the Doha Development Agenda at the WTO to guarantee more market access, eliminate agricultural export subsidies, and deal with non-trade concerns such as food security and rural development. Complex global forces. With the end of the Cold War, globalization became a major theme. Through the global integration of markets in a hyper-connected world, it extended, among others, into the fields of trade, finance, transportation, telecommunications, media, and culture. Countries organized in regional blocs that signed international agreements with other regions or great powers related to areas of common interest. But paradoxically, at the same time that globalization was beginning to spread around the globe, an opposite process of fragmentation was also coming about. And I use the word fragmentation here in a different way as was used this morning, referring to multilateral institutions. Here I refer to countries, trends that have been taking place with the end of the Cold War. And and we see that the collapse of the Soviet Union, because of this process, this dual process of globalization and fragmentation, we see the collapse of the Soviet Union giving way to the creation of 15 independent sovereign states. We see Czechoslovakia in a split into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. The former socialist Republic of Yugoslavia, led by Joseph Broz Tito, broke up into 5 countries, and there is a wave of nationalism and separatism that's sweeping various countries in different continents around the globe. And each separation, each country that separates, will want to be part of a larger organization, in this case of the European Union. You see Catalonia trying to separate from Spain, and if they achieve that, then they want to be part of a, of a supranational organization like the European Union or a state member of the UN. So this is the process, it's a very complicated, I would say, a paradoxical process of globalization, fragmentation, integration at the same time. But now the world has become multipolar, and not only because the U.S. might be in decline, but due to the emergence of new global and regional powers such as the BRICS, countries like Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the G7, the G20, etc. And of course, the most representative of all, which is the less mentioned, is the G195, which is all the members of the UN that participate in the General Assembly. There is the idea that during the last two decades, there has been a power shift from west to east and from north to south, creating the conditions for a post-Western order that finds no parallel in history. Thus, instead of a new world order proclaimed at the beginning of the 90s, what now seems to prevail is more a new world disorder or a new global anarchy, which is creating political confusion, market turbulence, and social unrest around the world. But whatever it may be, the reality is that the world is facing common global challenges that should be addressed, not in isolation by specific countries, but by the whole international community in general. Among those challenges, labeled as a cocktail of risks by George Osborne, the UK Chancellor, are the still moderate economic recovery from the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, the continuing turmoils in the financial markets that generate lack of confidence in investors and instability in the global economy, the large concentration of wealth in small groups that is the main cause for current social inequality, the high unemployment rate, especially among the youth, rising public debt, the scarcity of fresh water, climate change, and the current European migration crisis. Global risks also include Russia's conflict with the West, related to the situation in Ukraine, China's increasing presence in the South Sea, China Sea, in its skirmishes with Japan over disputed territories, and North Korea's nuclear tests in the Pacific Ocean. According to traditional international relations theories, all of these issues should be of the specific concern and interest of states being affected by it. This is so because, presumably, sovereign states only intervene in global affairs when they pursue their own self-interests in detriment of all others, thus creating a sense of anarchy in the international landscape. That is not true anymore. In today's world, sovereign states must act together to control, regulate, and coordinate actions related to global issues of common interest. In doing so, new actors, such as NGOs, civil society, social movements, transnational corporations, scholars, and the media, will also intervene through collaborative networks and public-private partnerships. This is the essence of global governance in the 21st century. It is not to weaken the role of states in their domestic or foreign affairs. It is rather to collaborate in a common task of navigating through uncertainty and in dealing with global risks. At the center of all this institutional network, of course, is the UN system, with its capacity to convene 195 member states, which has a diverse group of agencies focusing, among others, on the areas of peace, security, human rights, the environment, and sustainable development. The UN must undertake a process of profound changes to continue being an organization of relevance and prestige on the global scene. It must go beyond the framework created in the aftermath of the Second World War that corresponds to a world different from that in which we live today. It must adapt, and someone said this morning, readjust. It must readjust to the new circumstances guided by complex forces of global scope. Global prospects. According to a World Bank report, Global Economic Prospects recently released, global economic growth fell short of expectations in 2015, slowing to 2.4%. The disappointing performance was attributed to a continued deceleration of economic growth in emerging and developing economies, caused by a drop in commodity prices, global trade, and capital flows. And this is a change of trend, because before it was developing countries and emerging economies that were growing and high-income countries that were slowing. So we're looking in the past 2-3 years in a change of trend, where now we're seeing developing countries and emerging economies dropping in their growth and developing countries then having better economic output. Commodity prices continued to fall in 2015, with no significant expectations for change this year. Prices for metal and energy, oil, gas, and coal, slipped by almost 50%, and food prices by 30%. Global trade has been growing even more slowly than the global economy, with a meager expansion of just 1.5% in 2015, this being the lowest rate since the global financial crisis of 2007-2008. Global trade is expected to rise modestly in 2016 by 2.5%. That's 1% in addition. Financial flows to emerging economies were 65% less in 2015 than the amount registered the prior year. Looking into the future, global growth is expected to increase, but at a lower pace than was originally thought, reaching 2.9% this year, 2016, and 3.1% 2017-2018. Global inflation is expected to increase in a modest way, but will remain low by historical standards. In developing countries, growth in 2015 became to a post-crisis low of 4.3%, in a trend unprecedented since the 1980s, most of the largest economies in each region have been slowing at the same time for 3 consecutive years. Now, contrary to developing countries, high-income countries continue their recovery last year, in 2015, driven by an increase in domestic demand, a lowering of the jobless rate, and improved credit conditions. Nevertheless, 2016 growth forecasts for high-income countries have been considered on the downside due to the effect on the U.S. of a stronger dollar and the impact on Japan of slowing trade in Asia. In the U.S., for 2015, economic activity expanded to 2.5%, the highest annual rate in the post-crisis period. The main drivers in that recovery were a strong labor market. The U.S. was creating 200,000 jobs per month, so over 2 million jobs during 2015. So creating a strong labor market, sound consumer spending, and healthy investments in the non-oil private sector. These were the main drivers for economic growth in the U.S. in 2015. Job creation averaged more than 200,000 per month in 2015, and unemployment rate fell to 5% in the final quarter of the year. A recovery in housing markets and prospects of strengthening wage growth support a positive outlook for 2016. The euro area, it grew to 1.5% last year as domestic demand strengthened and exports accelerated, with economic activity improving in Spain, disappointing in Germany, and still lagging in France and Italy. Since the start of the European Central Bank's quantitative easing program, emulating the Federal Reserve in a delay, credit conditions have improved and credit growth has resumed after various years of spending cuts and austerity measures. And this has been a great debate on how the U.S. and Europe reacted differently to the global financial crisis. While in the U.S., it was a monetary expansive policy, allocating resources within the capital markets, $85 billion per month, in order to have economic growth and reduction in unemployment, the European response to the crisis was totally contrary. It was spending cuts, it was austerity measures that created social unrest, and political upheaval or political dissatisfaction to the point, and I was telling this to Don Enrique during lunchtime, that from 2008 to 2013, out of the 22 governments established in Europe, 21 lost the elections. Only Angela Merkel was able to survive. So that was the reaction, the political reaction generated by spending cuts or austerity measures within the situation of a global recession. Peripheral economies have been little affected by contagion from the Greece crisis. A third bailout program was agreed to with European partners, amounting to $95 billion. In China, growth in 2015 is estimated at 6.9%, down from 7.3% in 2014. And of course, China is coming down from a 12% annual average economic growth to 6 point something between 2015 and 2016. The deceleration reflects a troubling situation in the real estate market and industrial sector, both with considerably overcapacity, and in the case of industry, a high presence of state-owned enterprises. These sectors, the real estate markets and industry, saw the largest increase in investment and leverage during 2009-2013, resulting in a huge amount of debt among a small number of large firms. The Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, ECLAC, in Spanish we say CEPAL, has stated that in 2015, Latin American economy shrank by 0.4%, representing the worst performance in the region since 2009. Large differences in economic activities were seen between subregions and between countries. The regional downturn in South America was highly determined by negative growth in Brazil and Venezuela. The Central American countries continued to expand at a 4.4% rate, and the English and Dutch-speaking Caribbean experienced a 1.0% growth last year. Now, the difference that you can see between South America, Central America, the Caribbean, and Mexico is that the South American countries have been more linked to the Chinese economy. They were exporting commodities to China, oil, gas, copper, soya, soybeans. No, they were exporting all these commodities to China. With the deceleration of Chinese economy, these countries, Brazil, Venezuela, Peru, Ecuador, Argentina, have been impacted by the deceleration of the Chinese economy. Now, the Central American, the Caribbean, and Mexico is more integrated into the U.S. economy. And since the U.S. economy has been recovering from the impact of the global financial crisis, then these countries have a better economic output than the ones in the southern side. So the reestablishment of formal diplomatic relations between Cuba and the U.S., the Colombian government peace talks with the outdated FARC guerrilla forces, and the continuation of the expansion of the Panama Canal were all very positive signs for the advancement of the Latin American region. A tale of two cities. After years of sustained economic growth, China is decelerating in terms of growth, which has fallen to its lowest level since 2009. Its foreign exchange reserves have declined in more than $1 trillion. There is a fear that the second largest economy in the world might be heading for a hard landing that will drag down other leading economies into a severe slowdown or even another global recession. Investors around the world became concerned when China's stock market began to crumble at the middle of last year, causing prices for oil, gold, and copper to collapse. Since then, oil prices have fallen to their lowest level in nearly 12 years. It has dropped more than 65% since a peak 18 months ago, as there seems to be an oversupply and a decreasing demand, especially from China. Industrial metals, another important reference for global commodities prices, as has been stated, also fell. China is the second consumer of crude in the world and accounts for about half of global metal demands. But lack of industrial demand has pushed down imports of metals, sending commodity prices into a tailspin. As market volatility has begun to impact China again, and stocks around the world have plunged, there is concern among economists and global investors that another 2008 type of global financial crisis is on its way. Speaking at an economic forum in Colombo, Sri Lanka's capital, the well-known billionaire investor George Soros declared that, quote, China is struggling to find a new growth model, and its currency devaluation is transferring problems to the rest of the world, and a return to rising interest rates was proving difficult for the developing world, end of quote. He added, quote again, when I look at the financial markets, there is a serious challenge which reminds me of the crisis we had in 2008, end of quote. Due to turbulence in China and a crash in oil prices, others are indicating that the financial markets should brace in 2016 for the worst year on Wall Street since the implosion of Lehman Brothers in 2008. But still, other market analysts consider there is an exaggeration in this type of comparison. They think China is not going to implode and that there is little risk of contagion since banks have cleaned up their balance sheets after the credit crisis 8 years ago. All these opposing arguments, as we can appreciate, creates confusion, lack of understanding, and uncertainty as to where the markets are heading and what to expect from the global economy. It is well known that China is going through a transition from an exported and factory to the world to an economy that is driven by domestic demand. On the other hand, new conflicts have emerged that generate uneasiness and anxiety on the world platform, such as the recent tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and as an extension between Sunnis and Shiites in the Muslim world. These conflicts and tensions have been sending oil prices to lows not seen for more than a decade, contrary to previous experiences. Together, Saudi Arabia and Iran account for a quarter of the planet's proven oil reserves, and not long ago, such a conflict would have sent oil prices skyrocketing. In fact, it did, but very briefly, as oil increased above $38 per barrel, but rapidly retreated below 36 and has continued to drop into the low 30s. Yesterday, it came exactly to $29, the Brent benchmark. The lack of reaction in the global market has been quite amazing, since Saudi Arabia and Iran not only hold more than 400 billion barrels of oil, but they are located near the Strait of Hormuz, which is the world's most important oil shipping channel, with 17 million barrels flowing through it each day. The geopolitical premium that oil prices used to have is no longer there. It's been removed by the supply gluts put in place by the U.S. shale boom since mid-2014 and the decrease in demand by China. In addition to the Saudi Arabia-Iran tension, there is a war at this moment between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, a civil war in Syria that has expanded into a regional and global conflict, a chaotic situation in Libya, continuing warfare in Iraq, political unrest in Egypt, the rise and expansion of ISIS, the reemergence of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and a refugee burden in Lebanon and Jordan. Never has the Middle East seen so many conflicts piled up together and oil prices so low. It has been a policy of Saudi Arabia and OPEC to maintain current levels of production in order to keep low oil prices, by which they intend to discourage shale gas producers in the U.S. that were competing for market shares with traditional crude exporters. Crude prices will not get better in the short term. Most oil experts believe prices will bounce back by the end of 2016, but they expect more pain to come first. Goldman Sachs forecasts it will average $30 in February, even lower than for most of 2015, and it doesn't seem that way that it's going to happen. In a report by analysts at Morgan Stanley, it is indicated that the strengthening of the U.S. dollar could send oil plunging to $20 per barrel. This is because a 5% increase in the value of the dollar against a basket of currencies could push oil down by between $10 to $15, by between 10 to 15%, which would mean prices falling by as much as $8 per barrel. Countries that produce the world's crude are being strained by low prices. Large budget surpluses are turning into deficits, and highly beneficial social programs are being replaced with austerity measures. Today we saw a sign of that. We could have never imagined that Qatar was going to shut down Al Jazeera America, and it has done that because of budgetary problems. Venezuela, whose economy is now on the brink of collapse, inflation increased over 150% in 2015 and is expected to rise over 200% this year, 2016. So Venezuela is entering into a hyperinflation situation. Food and basic products are in short supply. So these are some of the countries. No, Venezuela is one that is being highly impacted by low oil prices. Russia, of course, where nearly half of the government's revenue come from gas and oil exports. The drop in oil prices came when Russia was already being affected by Western economic sanctions over its involvement in the crisis with Ukraine. Russian GDP shrank by 3.8% in 2015 and is expected to reduce by another 0.6% in 2016. I should stop here and say that there's some sort of conspiracy theory about why the fall of the oil prices. It's been said that Saudi Arabia and the U.S. somehow made a hidden agreement. Saudi Arabia was concerned that U.S. shale gas was taking away market shares because the U.S. has become, I would say, a world power in terms of energy with the fracking that has taken place. Hydraulic fracking has created the U.S. a major shale gas and oil producer. So Saudi Arabia was concerned that the U.S. was going to take market share. But the U.S. was also considering if oil prices fell. They had three issues on the agenda: Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. So if oil prices fell with the economic sanctions already in place against Russia, it will weaken Putin's stand, and some sort of negotiation over Ukraine will take over. In Iran, because the U.S. wanted to have a deal on the nuclear issue, and Venezuela to weaken the Venezuelan government. So this is a conspiracy theory on how or why also the oil has fell. Iraq, low prices are demolishing the country's finances at a time when there is a need to fund its war against ISIS. Iraq pumped record amounts last year, but the increase in production did not compensate for the drop in prices. We also have Nigeria that's been highly impacted. And so overall, on the Middle East, the IMF has warned that it will take years for countries in the region to recover, particularly those in the Gulf that remain overly dependent on crude oil exports. The fiscal fluctuation for the six countries in the region will add up to a budget deficit of $700 billion in the next 5 years. The countries most exposed are the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman, and Bahrain. The IMF projects growth across the Middle East at 2.5% in 2016, half the rate of 3 years ago. Saudi Arabia, whose government ran a nearly $100 billion deficit last year due to low oil prices, has announced strict austerity measures in 2016. The collapse in prices has wreaked havoc in the industry, causing tens of thousands of job losses and a surge in corporate defaults. A growing number of American oil producers with lots of debt are facing financial problems. It's a dramatic shift from just a few years ago. The roaring junk bond market and low interest rates helped fuel the U.S. energy boom. Cheap credits enable companies to invest in new technologies like hydraulic fracking that makes it easier to drill oil in difficult places. Back then, many companies with business models that made no rational sense had access to the bond markets for funding. But lately, there's been an increase in credit costs for risky oil companies. Cheap oil is putting energy companies under financial stress. It is creating headaches for the Wall Street firms that bankrolled America's oil boom. Oil revenue has dried up, but these companies, they are still burdened by huge debts. More than 100 global corporate defaults occurred during 2015. That represents the first time a triple-digit default milestone has been crossed since the beginning of the Great Recession. According to S&P, almost one-third of those companies' defaults were in the oil, gas, or energy business. Emerging market defaults also increased dramatically in 2015. That could continue to be a problem because of the appreciation of the U.S. dollar, especially in places like Brazil. A super strong U.S. dollar makes it more difficult for foreign companies to pay back debt they took on what was priced in U.S. dollars. Investors cannot get their cash out of emerging markets quickly enough. Money has been pouring out of developing countries at a faster pace and for a longer period of time than during the global financial crisis of 2008-2009. About $1 trillion U.S. dollars has been withdrawn since July 2014, which is double the amount that fled during the financial crisis. U.S. largest banks are raising red flags about the health of energy company loans. Banks are going to lose money on the loans they've made. Wells Fargo said it was forced to set aside more cash to cushion against potential commercial defaults due to the deterioration in the energy sector. Bank of America reported it may need to set aside an additional 15% to deal with troubled commercial loans, especially in its oil and gas portfolio. New oil and gas production projects, new projects that were on the table, worth $1.5 trillion, are at risk because of falling prices. The planned projects are unlikely to go ahead because they are uneconomic at current prices of less than $50 a barrel. A total of 46 projects have been deferred as a result of the oil price fall in 2015. Investments were cut by $220 billion, and many more investment plans were scrapped. Société Générale predicts oil could rise to $51 a barrel in the third quarter of 2016. Still, there seems to be little risk of crude oil returning anytime soon to $100 a barrel. That is a sign of how much the U.S. shale revolution has reshaped the energy landscape. By July of last year, gold plunged to its lowest level in 5 years, below $1,100 an ounce. And we remember that just about 15 months ago, we had gold at $1,800 an ounce. Now it's been down to $1,100. Mining stocks like Barrick Gold, Newmont Mining, and Coeur Mining are down 20 to 25%. All this has been triggered by heavy selling overnight, signaling Chinese demand was going to be weaker than expected. A big question for 2016 is how strong, healthy, and resilient the United States economy will be and how it will exercise its global leadership in tackling global issues and engaging in international conflicts. The monetary expansive policy implemented by the Federal Reserve as a response to the 2008 financial crisis enables the U.S. to avoid the collapse of the financial sector, the stagnation that affected other nations, and the social unrest that still prevails in certain regions of the world. The relevance about the sustainability of U.S. economic growth, investors and consumers' confidence, job creation opportunities, and innovative capacity is due to the interdependence of the global economy. But of course, the two big questions in 2016 will be the U.S. presidential elections and the British referendum, or Brexit, on whether to remain or not a member of the European Union. Looking into the days ahead, uncertainty seems inevitable. The world is at a crossroad, going through an unprecedented process of radical accelerated change. Within that process, the forces of the past are resisting to die, while the forces that will shape the future are still struggling to fully come to life. In that process, we are all trapped, as have been all generations that came before us in great periods of historical transformations. So, no more than now, we can identify ourselves with the words of wisdom written by a great Brit, Charles Dickens, more than 150 years ago, in the opening sentence of his famous masterpiece, A Tale of Two Cities, in which he stated, and we all know this, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We're all going to heaven. We're all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so much like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. Thank you very much.